Hello, and welcome to the show. I'm Johnny, your host. This is a special show for me because of the guest. It's a big reason how I figured out what kind of show I wanted to do, and we will get into that in just a minute. First of all, I have a friend, JJ Johnson. He's a drummer. He's played with a lot of people, namely John Mayer, Doyle Bramhall, too. He has had some health issues and had to spend a few days in the hospital. He is uninsured, as most of us are, and he's having a benefit at the Elephant Room here in Austin on Sunday, June 10th. It's Sunday night. I know my friend Kevin Lovejoy is playing. I know my friend Elias Hasslinger is playing. People I've known for a long time. I've known JJ for a long time. He's a fantastic guy. I know it's hard. He's got kids and stuff. Anyway... if you're in Austin on Sunday, go out, try and support. If not, look it up. I'm sure if you Google JJ Johnson benefit, it'll come up and you can donate. Throw in a little cashish, as I like to say, to the people. For the people, if you will. Thank you. Speaking of cashish, I need to pay some bills here. Today's episode of How Did I Get Here is brought to you by the Law Office of Charlie Roadman in Austin, Texas. He's a defense attorney and he deals in all felonies and misdemeanors. You can find him on the web at roadmanlaw.com. That's roadmanlaw.com. Or you can call him for a free consultation at 512-472-1113. Now, I've known Charlie for a long time, since the mid-90s or so. Our bands used to play together. He's a musician. While he was a musician, or while he still is a musician, but while he was out there playing a lot, his day job was to teach the LSAT and the Princeton Law Review. And so after teaching it for a while and kind of learning the ins and outs of it, he decided to take it. When he took it, he aced it. He went to law school. He came out and decided to become a defense attorney. And he's a very understanding person. He has compassion towards musicians. He does a marijuana law for musicians thing once a year, maybe even twice, where he explains the laws to people so that you understand what you're dealing with. And so anyway, he's an understanding guy. So you can call him for a free consultation, 512-472-1113, or find him at the web on the web at roadmanlaw.com. All right? So you don't have to hire him, but if your predicament involves a policeman, give him a call. In the free consultation, if he can't help you, he'll find someone that can. So give him a call over there. Charlie Roadman, thank you. Now on with the show. All right, so my guest today is Nakia. We talk about some stuff, like when I set out to do the podcast, it was watching him that made me decide what kind of show I wanted to do. And so I've been trying to have this conversation with him since before I started. So now we're in the 70s, and I'm glad we actually had it now, because we got to talk about what happens post-voice and his new album. He's got a Pledge Music thing on his website that he's trying to raise some money to do the record, finish it up, put it out, get it to you guys. And there's all kinds of incentives. You get some demos that he's doing, and we play one at the end of the show. He actually was generous enough to throw one our way over here. Threw us a bone, a little Nakia. Anyway, so I went to go see Nakia the night before we did this interview, and it was fantastic. I had a great time, and I really like Nakia. I like what he does, and I'm going to let the interview speak for itself. I'm not going to give you too much, but we answer some Twitter questions, and we get to the bottom of stuff. So without further ado, here's my friend Nakia. Let's get down. Why can't we be humble like the good Lord said? He promised to exalt us, but So we were just saying this is kind of how you came into my consciousness.
That's correct.
As Nakia.
As Nakia, yeah.
Yeah.
Before that, I was kind of, to most people in Austin, especially most musicians in Austin, I was Vic Odin.
Vic Odin.
Yeah, the surly British manager of the Small Stars, Miles Zuniga, or should I say Guy Fantasy's alter ego band.
How fun was that?
It was a lot of fun.
I had Miles on here, and he talked about how great it was. It was a liberating.
For him, it was super liberating.
He got to do his. He's one of those guys like me that kind of fancies himself a stand-up comic but has to play music to make money.
Yeah, and Guy Fantasy was the perfect outlet for him. And I think it still is. I think that there's going to be a time when he's going to need Guy again.
Yeah.
And I hope he'll also need Vic.
Be coming soon. So, hey, so I saw you play last night, and I'm really glad that I did.
And I'm really glad that you did, too, and I'm so sorry. I forgot to put you on the list.
Oh, that's no problem. I know exactly. I mean, that's the cool thing about being a musician is you know that exact. I saw it in your face.
I knew you would.
And I was like, no, don't worry, don't worry. I know that feeling when the dude still shows up and you're like, oh fuck,
I blew it.
Because there's that time when you're walking on stage, you haven't seen the dude yet, and you're like, oh, I forgot to put him on this. Well, maybe he won't come.
Right. And then there's the time when you look out and there he is.
He paid.
Right.
No, I had no problem with it. I wanted to. It reinforced. We heard That's the Way God Planned It. That's when I first heard of you.
Sure.
And I saw. I wasn't there at that show. Believe it or not, I was. I saw it on video a lot. Like everyone was posting it on their Facebook. And it
Wilson
was, like,
was the first guy I think to grab it. He filmed videoed it, and then I posted it.
But it was really like it was really like it was a big moment in Austin. It was like all the right people were at this show.
Oh, man,
and
it
you
was cool.
And you did this performance that blew everyone away. And then at some point I was like, what in the, you know, who is this guy? What is this, you know? And so then I'd see you from time to time. And then the worst part about it was, and I'm going to be totally honest because that's what I do on this show, is that I saw you one time during South by Southwest. I don't know if you remember this, but I had to disassociate you from this experience that I was having outside of you, which was, I played with Skyrocket at the Raji party.
Yes.
And then I had to, my stuff was set up for another gig. I had to go to that gig, but I had to poop.
Is this a, did this happen at Big Red Sun?
Yeah, but it was in the alley behind Big Red Sun. And you were so friendly. And I was with my best friend, Joseph, who was like, dude, you know, like when we walked away, he was like, well, how could you not disengage from that conversation? We're like, dude, seriously, I was shitting in my pants the whole time I was like talking to Nakia. So anyway, so I disassociated myself from this. And then I have to tell you this, that I remember there was a lot of buzz that you were going to be on this new show, a singing show, a competition show.
Right.
And then, I'm sorry. This is just me. The whole interview is just going to be me telling you what I saw you do once. So I was excited about it, and my girlfriend Jessie and I walked down to Baby A's, and we had some drinks and dinner, and we came back and we sat down to watch the show, and you came out and did Forget You, and I wasn't like oh man, you know, this is amazing, Nakia. I was just like, what's this dude, you know, how's he gonna do this? This is gonna be weird, you know.
Right.
And then if you started singing that song. And I was just like, wow, this guy's got balls. He's like singing the song to the dude. I mean, that's a pretty heavy fuck. I mean, that was a huge way to come out on that show, right?
It was. I was the only, you know, other people did sing either coaches songs or wives of coaches songs. But I was the only one that had a coach turn around, you know, that I was actually singing their song, you know.
Right, yeah.
And it was,
the look on his face when he turned around too is pretty amazing.
It's priceless. I mean, and Blake's too, because, you know, and Blake told me, you know, later, and I think they actually, he said this on camera, but I don't think they kept it on, was that he thought I was a black guy.
Yeah. Well, you have
so
that.
They were both like,
yeah.
Burm,
yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, at that moment, all of a sudden, I developed this incredible empathy for you and your situation, and I just like, I realized your talent at that moment was so big. And then also in the face, like, I follow you on Twitter, whatever, right. I see you on Facebook, you know, hey, come on out to the Saxon Pub, I'm playing, hey, come on to the Saxon Pub. I'm like, this guy literally skipped all these steps to, like, performing for millions of people in this giant situation that he's just not normally used to. And it was like, there was, undeniable that you actually belonged in this situation.
Oh, thanks, man.
Thank you. Was really amazing. And then I just was fascinated. And actually, it while I was watching that performance, I knew I wanted to start a podcast.
Right.
And that was thinking about your situation and really wanting, like, I was like, what is he going through? You know what I mean? Like, right. what are you going through in that situation? Like, you know, that is a completely different situation than you were in the week before.
Absolutely. Yeah. It does. It literally can be just night and day difference to what you're doing. I mean, you know, you go from not having anybody to be responsible for you other than yourself to having all these people who it's their job to make sure you get up on time,
yeah.
get where you're going, get you in a van, get you dressed.
Yeah.
All of those things.
You're the center of all of this energy.
Yeah, you know, it's somebody's job to take care of you. And then the further along you get, obviously the more time you get with your coach, the more
right.
the more time that you get to spend with the band, and then it becomes really, like, centered on you. While it's your turn to be in the room with those people, they're very focused on you. And, you know, you're really, and when you're not with them, especially later on when there's less other artists around to connect with, you're kind of on your own. You know, it's you and the fans.
Right.
The cool thing is they were the first show to let the contestants, you know, start interacting on social media from the get-go.
Right.
And so we got to connect with fans that way. And, you know, and I stay connected with Robert and family, you know, via phone and text and FaceTime and all of that. But aside from that, you're kind of on your own, you
yeah.
know? And so it really kind of forces you into taking a lot of inventory of yourself while
yeah.
you're doing it, making
yeah.
sure that this is correct. Does this look great? You know, does it sound great? You know, how to, you know, there was times where they, you know, they'd say, well, we want you to do these dance moves and, you know, this choreography, and I would say, no.
Yeah.
You know, like, there was only a few things that I personally said, that's not who I am as an artist, or that's not, I don't think that this works for me.
Right.
You know, or most of the time I would say, I'm not a big fan of this, but I am of this. What do you think?
Right.
You know, and so it was a very good experience for me, and I honestly,
it seems ultimately like it was.
Yeah, and I honestly, I truly believe that everything I did up until that moment led to that. You know, like,
that's what it felt like watching you.
It was the perfect thing for me at the time because, you know, what came next and what I'm doing now.
Yeah.
All of what I'm doing now and how I'm interacting and with everybody, really, from my family to my fans. I really feel like that I learned so much just from that short time on the show.
Right.
And it kind of validated everything else that I've been doing.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Were you at a point before you were on that show, were you at a point where you were kind of like, okay,
this is it.
Like, what am I doing?
Yeah. Like, I, you know,
yeah.
It's Fridays at Saxon at midnight and while that's, and trust me.
There's nothing wrong with that.
There's no, and
but
trust me.
But we start
I
out
really,
with a dream.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And honestly, I think part of my dream is Saxon's at midnight. That's the thing, is like, I really enjoy that part of it. I really enjoy, was just having that conversation with Eric Jarvis about how we prefer to play the Saxon over just every other kind of big festival or whatever a lot of the times, because it's such a different connection to people,
yeah.
you know, and it's intimate, you know, and I mean, there's always going to be big festivals to play.
Yeah.
But, you know, how many times a year do I get to just come home to the Saxon and play at midnight and just do our thing? You know
yeah.
what I mean? And not worry about anything else,
right.
but just be
right.
there, you know? So it is definitely part of my dream because it makes me happy.
Right, right. That's a thing there's like a part, there's a thing in Austin, I think, that makes it easy for us to live here is that you can kind of, you can develop in public.
Oh yeah.
And not really be judged like you would.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, yeah. You know, you can figure out who you are and what you're doing.
No, totally. Yeah. And I actually, that's one of the things that I think my time leading up to The Voice that I spent a lot of time doing, which was watching other people do just that.
Yeah.
And watching how they did things right. And in some cases, how they did things wrong.
Yeah.
And spending time with people like Miles and Tommy Shannon and
guys that have been through this.
Yeah. And just kind of absorbing it.
Yeah.
You know, and I've always, you know, as a kid, I was fascinated by music and musicians, and I was definitely, you know, like a hairband groupie, you know. So I mean every star that I ever wanted to meet, that I tried to meet or whatever, whether it was musician or actor or whatever, I've always had this weird thing that, like, even if I just shake their hand, like, part of them has rubbed off on me. Like, you know, like, there's something good that's going to come from that. And so when I moved to Austin, it was like, you know, all of these musicians that I looked up to and that I really admired were just everywhere. And even if they didn't live here, maybe they were hanging out here for a bit, or maybe they were here for a couple of days or just one night.
This is a place you'll run into those people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And so, especially at Continental Club. And so, to me, I just took that when I got here, and I was like, now, it's not even having to meet them. I'm here. I'm absorbing it everywhere I go.
Yeah.
You know, so.
So you like it. So you're from, you said when you were a kid, so you went, you're from Virginia Beach, Virginia.
I was born there.
You were born there.
Yeah, lived there for 2 years.
Okay, where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Alabama.
Okay. How was that? Where in Alabama?
Fort Payne, Alabama. It's the northeastern tip.
Did it live up to its name, Fort Payne?
It did. You know, bless its heart. I love Fort Payne. I love Collinsville. That's the two main little cities that I grew up in. And my parents, when they divorced, we'd lived there for 11 years in Collinsville. And then we all moved to Fort Payne, about 20 miles north. But my grandmother still lived there, and she does now. I knew from a very young age that I was gay.
Yeah.
And so being in Northeast, you know, Alabama, or probably in Alabama in general.
Yeah. I don't think there's like a safe haven in Alabama.
I don't think so.
They don't have an Austin.
Right. Yeah. but, you know, I mean, it was not easy because I don't know, at a very young age, I just wanted to tell people that I was gay. I was trying so hard to find other people to identify with and befriend and just be a part of something, you know, that as soon as I could start figuring it out, I was just like blabbing it to people. So I got my ass kicked a lot, you know, and my grandmother, even to this day, it's like, still holds a grudge with herself because I begged her 1 year to let me live with her after my parents divorced because I didn't want to go to a new school. But I was getting beat up so much at this old school that she was convinced that going to the new school would help me. And so she opted to say no. She never told me no my entire life or anything else. And she said, no, you can't live with me. You have to go with your parents. One of your parents, pick your parents, you know. And she told me later because she was afraid I was going to get killed, basically. But,
how old were you then? You're 11.
I was 11, 12.
And you knew you were gay when you were 11?
I was gay when I was like 5.
Did your parents know? Did you come out
my
to people? Did you have
said
to come out?
Or was later. It? I came out to them when I was 19 officially. And they said later that they always knew I was gay.
Was it awkward in that situation? Because it was always weird in my family because my family's Hispanic and really macho, you know.
Oh, wow. I did not know that.
Yeah, I'm Cuban. So,
oh, wow.
There's a lot of that, just a lot of, you know, macho, anti-gay. What are you, gay? You know, that kind of, you know.
There wasn't, when I came out with my family, they were really supportive. I'll never forget, I told my dad first, on my way to a theater class in college, he was driving me, I didn't have a car at the time. So on my way to a theater class, I asked my dad, I said, you know, are you always going to love me no matter what? And he was like, yeah. And I was like, well, okay, cool, because I'm gay. He was like, yeah, you know, I'm fine with that. I kind of figured, you know, but I wasn't sure. And you had said some things in high school, and maybe you were, maybe you weren't. But you know, me and your mom always knew, and you know, you'd probably just want to be, you know, careful how you tell her or break her the news or whatever, you know.
Right.
And So me,
it's
being
very
this,
weird. It's very weird that that has to be an issue. Right. Isn't it just the fact that that is an issue is very odd to me because I've never experienced that sort of thing. You know, like.
But the funny thing is that when I told my mom, she said, "Oh my God, don't tell your dad." And I was like, "But I already told my dad." And then she said, "You told your dad first."
Oh,
you know, so it was that neither of them really knew what the other was thinking. They were both just expressing whatever it is they thought they were expressing. And then my mother said, "Don't tell your grandmother." And then she called my grandmother and told her herself. So it was like, you know, they were fine with it. And they love, you know, they've always loved whatever boyfriend I've had. I've had like three major boyfriends in my life. So they love Robert. Yeah. And my mother loves Tyson to death. She's never met him, but she always sees pictures and video of him and stuff. So they're very accepting. My grandmother, who's in a nursing home, is 93 this year, I think. And,
wow.
And she's, you know, constantly asking about Robert and how Robert is. And
that's good.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for the most part, my family, even though my dad was Mexican, you know, he grew up in a very Mexican macho household.
Yeah.
And all Spanish speaking. He wasn't allowed to speak English in the house, you know. And he left home at 16 to join the Navy, like, you know, take off, whatever. And he swore when we were kids, before we were born, I guess, that, you know, it would be an English speaking house. And he never tried to teach us Spanish. And
wow, he's always trying to get away from it.
Yeah, and you know, and he always wanted us to be American kids or whatever. And I used to tell people, and they said, "Well, what are you?" When I would, you know, I'd be like 5 years old. And
right.
You know, "My name is Nakia." Well, what are you?
Yeah.
And I guess either my parents told me what that meant or I figured it out or whatever. But I would put my hands on my hips and I would say, "I'm part Indian, part Mexican, and all American." Somebody had to teach me that shit. But apparently it worked. So, you know, I always got kisses and hugs and that's how I knew I loved to sing, was because I was, you know, 5 years old in kindergarten or preschool, whatever, and my babysitter would come get me from my kindergarten class and take me to the home ec room in the senior hall with all of the cheerleaders, and they would have me sing Beth by Kiss.
That's awesome.
And so I was, you know, 5 years old, and these, you know, high school senior girls in the, I guess it was 1980.
Yeah.
We're all, you know, I loved it. And then, of course, I thought, this is something I want to keep doing.
Well, there's a magical feeling when you can, when you can take the, all of the attention in the room.
Oh, yeah.
And give back joy.
Yeah.
You know
totally.
What I mean?
Yeah.
I loved being funny when I was a kid, and my mom used to bring her friends. She was in college. They're all, you know, stoned or whatever, and they come over, and I was like three or something, and they'd be like, "Sing Three Dog Night," and then I'd bring my drum set out and play Beatles songs. And,
oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, we all have those kind of experiences, but that's just their joy. Just as they were so high and they're watching this kid like play his Archie drum set to Yellow Submarine.
That's killer.
They're getting
live Saturday morning cartoon.
Right. But they're getting But they're getting this. You're seeing the joy that you're bringing people, and that's a good feeling.
Oh yeah, yeah. And it's that kind of thing though that you know hooks us, I think, and keeps us coming back to do it again and again. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like last night at Stubbs, you know, I'm looking out at the audience and it never fails that I'm always going to be up there. And whatever moment I'm having in my head about the music, if I see somebody that is engaged and having that moment that they're really getting it, then it only just turns me up, you know, and then I want to connect with them some more and see how far out I can spread that around their friends or whatever.
Yeah.
And the same thing is true, though, if I see somebody that's, like, not in it, you know? And, like, it almost makes me want to work them harder, you know?
I find the one guy in the room that's not getting off.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that's, you know, man, I got that from you. And last night, I mean, obviously seeing these explosive performances on television.
Right.
And, you know, obviously somebody's going to really throw down. Last night, you know, it was a considerably smaller than a million people.
Right.
It was a good filled room.
Yeah, sure.
But you have this sort of like a blues dude ethic of like, you know, like a James Brown guy. Like if there's three fucking people there, you will still throw yourself on the ground.
Yeah.
You still, and it's not like a shtick. It's like you work yourself up into this kind of...
Yeah, it is. It's that has to, that climax has to happen for me.
Yeah.
Or why bother?
Right.
You know, I mean, if they don't get that,
it might be me.
It's David Cotton calling. If they don't
get him on the show,
right? Talk about how did you get here? Yeah. That would be, you'd have to do a double episode.
Oh, he would be like, he'd have to be a recurring guest.
Right.
We'd have to take it in doses.
I would personally, that would be something I would pay for.
Yeah.
But seriously, I mean, if I'm not having that moment up there.
Wait, I'm sorry. I missed a joke.
Right.
Trust me, you've paid for it.
If I'm not having that moment up there, then that's why I'm doing it. You know, I've got to have that, you know, that boom back, you know. And sure, sometimes there's not going to be, you know, a million people there. In fact, I would venture to say most of the time there's not.
Right. Sometimes you're not going to be on the number one rated show when you're singing.
Right, yeah.
You're going to be at Saxon Pub. It's going to be Friday.
And that's the thing that, you know, people keep, like, there was a thing that came out in Dallas Observer's blog today called DC 9 at 9 or whatever. And it basically is, the headline is, Nakia finds his voice on The Voice. Now what? You know?
That sucks. That was going to be the title of this show.
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the truth is, you know, doing this thing in Austin before The Voice is what made it easy for me to have the now what.
Yeah.
You know, I knew going on there that there would be a now what, you know. Right. I didn't go on there to win. I didn't go on there to get a record deal. I went on there so that those millions of people get to see what I do.
Right.
In hopes that I can just have a few of them.
Yeah.
I don't need them all.
No.
I don't want them all. I just want the few that really like me.
I don't want them all.
No, I don't. Yeah. I just want the few that really get it. Or even the ones that kind of get it and think, maybe, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what I think that, and I asked a lot of other people who had done television like this. Reality television, and said, what's your advice? You know, and every single one of them said, don't go on to win. Go on to do whatever it is you're doing and make a, you know, a good television show. I think that was a thing that like I immediately connected with was, oh, I can go make good television. You know, like,
yeah.
I have an acting background. I'm a singer, you know, like I'm used to cameras and
yeah.
I can go do that, you know? So it worked.
Wow. So when did you start playing out? Like after Five, when did you get it together that you were like, okay, I'm gonna do this. I'm gonna have a band. I'm gonna sing.
Right. Well, I started with just me and the piano first. When I lived in Atlanta in 1995, late 95.
You started playing out?
No.
No.
No. I started reteaching myself how to play piano.
Okay.
I moved into an apartment that was furnished with an upright piano. It was a basement apartment of this old couple in Decatur, Georgia. And I was working at this company called Media Play as a promotions manager. And I was just about to take on an internship working for Brendan O'Brien in his new record label in Atlanta. This place had a piano. And I had a few piano lessons as a kid that I kind of had forgot. But lo and behold, I kept all of my beginner's books.
Oh, cool.
So I remembered my mother and my piano teacher, Mrs. Brown, taking a pencil and writing the keys on the keys. So C, D, all of that stuff. And so I did that. I set up a tape.
I took mine off before you came.
Okay, good. I did that and I hit the tape recorder and I would just tape myself taking the lessons in these books.
Yeah.
And then I would teach myself basic chords and then I wrote my first song on the piano and... Da, 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 da. So I thought, well, I can do that part of it. That's cool. So when I moved home to Alabama in 96, I started playing little coffee shops, sandwich shops, but I didn't have an electric piano yet. So I would literally take my piano, my upright piano, and that I had when I moved home to Alabama, I bought for $50 at a Salvation Army, and I would put it in the back of my friend's truck, and I would take it to gigs and load it in and load it out. Because I didn't have an electric piano at the time. And then finally, my friend asked me to join his band as a keyboard player. And I did. And he said, but there's no way we can call your...
Yeah,
your piano around, we got to get you in touch with this guy, Jason Oden, and he owns a music store. And, you know, he's basically the guy that went from high school selling kids their trumpets and trombones.
Okay, yeah.
You know, and it was, you know, high dollar scheme of interest kind of thing. Yeah. You know? Rent to own, whatever you want to call it. It was not a pretty scene. But he had the very first, like, Kurzweil PC-88. And it did all the cool sounds and weighted keys and all that stuff. And it was, you know, it weighed 200 pounds or something. But it was, I might as well have been taking that thing. Yeah. But I got that from him and I started in that band. So that was in 96. That was called Late Night Breakfast. And I was the keyboard player, backing vocalist. And I did all of our choreography. Listen, we rehearsed for a year and had one show, so it's fine.
Wow.
But that choreography was amazing.
How was that show? Was it good?
It was sold out. It was great. Good. Because we just invited, in Alabama where we were, all we could really do is a dry town, no liquor at the time. You can buy liquor there now, but at the time you couldn't buy booze.
Right.
So all we could do was basically go to the county line, get booze, you know, or pot for our friends, whatever, have them come back to our rehearsal room at our buddy's house, and just hang out with us there.
Right.
And they would watch us rehearse and watch us go through and watch us have the arguments. It was kind of like reality TV.
Yeah, you're prepping yourself for
before
it.
That. And so by the time that we were ready to do a show, they were like, yeah, we'll give you $5. So we sold the joint out.
And they had gone through the whole experience with you. Yeah, like it was a reality show.
Yeah,
they finally got to go to the big show.
And they were really, really excited. And to be honest, it was a really good show. But, you know, it was one of those things where it just wasn't meant to be.
What were you doing for work at the time? Because it seems like your day jobs have kind of been music business.
I've been fortunate that I've had, you know, a few cool things like the Aware Records before I moved here in Chicago. I was an intern for them. And the same for Brendan O'Brien in Atlanta. And of course, you knew me through when I worked with Raji.
With Raji, yeah.
But aside from that, you know, if you could think about it, like just off the top of your head, name five either places to work or things to do, and I'll see if I've done them.
Okay, Whole Foods.
I've worked at a grocery store.
Okay, grocery store. Okay. You do physical house painting?
Yes, I've done house painting.
Have you done dog walking?
I've never done dog walking.
That seems like a good one.
That would be a good one.
So yeah. you just a slew of fucking jobs, basically.
Anything that you could possibly have, with the exception of dog walking.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, like I did construction. I worked for Hardee's, you know, countless drive-thrus. I was a clown at Pizza Hut. I did a lot of retail management jobs. In high school, I was a store manager for something called Sounds Unlimited. We sold cassettes and CDs. CDs were new then.
Right.
And that's how I would get into meet these bands, because I was friends with the radio guys who were like 40 miles away. That's how far our FM station was.
Right.
And would call them up on the phone and, you know, talk to them about, you know, how can I get, you know, promos or whatever. And I knew these guys from high school because when I was in high school, my dad worked at a Domino's Pizza. We would take the radio guys' pizza and they'd give us free concert tickets and free cassettes or whatever. And so when I got this job as a manager at the record store, the one record store in town, they helped me hook up with like the PolyGram people to get backstage for Kiss and that kind of thing, you know. And so I would take all my friends to go to these shows, you know, and that was kind of my thing. So that one job in high school, I was able to use on my resume and get assistant manager jobs at department stores, a store manager job at American Eagle. You know, I worked at the Gap, all of these places because of that one thing that I did in high school, you know. But it was really cool because it helped pay, you know, and I usually picked cool clothing stores to work at, so I usually had nice clothes.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, when I first moved here, I worked for Apple on the phone, and then I helped open their store. But when I lived in Chicago, there's a song on the new record called Dream Big, and there's a line that says, you know, when I got to Chicago, I couldn't even pay the toll, you know, because I left Alabama in like a hatchback with, you know, 13 garbage bags filled with my clothes and junk, you know. Moved to Chicago, got there, I literally didn't know there was a toll to get into there, so I didn't have any money. Somebody had to pay from like two cars behind me.
Oh my God.
Then I get into town and I don't have a job yet except for this internship, which doesn't pay.
Right.
I have a guy that I had met on the internet who's going to let me crash with him. Well, he turned out to be a total weirdo, so I had to move like that weekend.
Right.
And then I had to get real jobs while I was there. So I worked the internship until 5 p.m., and then I would go work at this place called Kitchen on Roscoe in Roscoe Village in Chicago, where I was a waiter at a restaurant that had a 70s kitsch theme, which is Kitchen on Roscoe. Like, Skyrocket would have been perfect for this restaurant.
Right.
Okay, like, the women's bathroom had a picture of Farrah Fawcett, and the men's bathroom had a picture of the Million Dollar Man.
Steve Austin.
Yeah.
Or Lee Majors.
Right. So then, you know, like, at night, when I was off of that gig, at 10 o'clock, when we closed, I would go work as a bouncer at the door for a gay bar in Boys Town. And I would do all those jobs, and then, and you know, we didn't get home until 4, and then wake up and go to the internship.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I did a lot of other stuff, you know.
Yeah, you kept going.
I had to. Yeah. You know, I mean, because I always knew that there was an end game of being happy doing music, you know.
Right.
But at the time, I really thought in Chicago, until I started, because I had stopped performing, and I was more focused on the marketing part of it. I got in when John Mayer and Train were really just taking off with this label. And so I was really heavily involved in the Mayer stuff in the Southeast, you know, like getting the word out to kids and students and all of that stuff. And so when I went to Chicago, I was convinced.
Street teams and college promo kids and stuff.
And I basically said, look, I've been doing such a good job for you here. Right. Why don't you hire me to come to Chicago and work as an intern? They're like, well, you're not in college. I'm like, exactly. So I'll work harder. You know.
Right, I need a job. I'm not going to do some fluff-off.
Yeah, just get me in the door. So I went up there and did that for, you know, like 8 months. And then I thought that's what I was going to do. And then while I was up there, as that was starting to end, I had stumbled into a piano bar in Boys Town called Gentry on Halsted. I don't even think it's open anymore. Well, on Tuesdays, this guy, it was like karaoke, but it was just him on the piano, and you brought your own sheet music. So all these, you know, queens would come in, and these divas would come in who wanted to sing show tunes.
Right. Yeah.
And he would play, you know, whatever, you know, My Funny Valentine, and all of that stuff. And all these standards. And I didn't really, I mean, I did musical theater, and I had a scholarship for musical theater, and I love musical theater, but I wanted to sing my songs. I was in a place where I was, you know, ready to sing some of my songs.
The songs that you wrote.
Songs that I wrote, and a couple of covers. You know, I think at the time my covers consisted of like Woodstock by Joni Mitchell, you know, and like maybe a Ryan Adams cover or something like that. You know, like just stuff me and the piano. Daniel by Elton John, I'm sure, was in there. Maybe a Sean Mullins song. But mainly my stuff. And so basically what I did was I went in and I pitched to him, hey, I know you play the piano normally, but I don't have anything on sheet music. So what if you took a break for 15 minutes?
Right.
I'll just do 3 tunes. Well, that happened enough times until one time it happened and the owner came in and goes, hey, man, you should have your own night here, you know? And
so
I did. And that was right as I was ending the record label thing. I came here for South by Southwest and met Robert, fell in love with the city, the whole scene or whatever. And my internship was ending at Aware that same, like literally the same time.
Yeah.
And it was just perfect timing.
And you moved here, and you started playing.
August,
yeah,
of 2002.
And when did you get into the Small Stars? How did that happen?
The Apple Store. I was working at the Apple Store at the Genius Bar, basically.
I was at the Genius Bar.
Right, of course. It's funny. I just bumped into what's the guy? Jack Ingram.
Yeah.
I sold him a computer. He was like, "It's funny, man. I saw you on TV, you know," and I was like, didn't that guy sell me a MacBook?
Yeah, here's a question I lost out on. I imagine, you know, just like with the advent of Facebook or like being a musician or something like that. And also, with my experience, I think it even aired last night because I had an unusual amount of activity of questions about my life and childhood. But did you hear from like the weird guy that you initially went to live with, you know, in Chicago?
No.
Like, he never like saw you on The Voice and like wrote you, looked you up on Facebook.
No,
like,
but there have been other people that I bumped into or that like I randomly like went on one date with or that kind of thing.
Yeah. What about someone that dumped you at some point?
No.
Did you have any elation? Like, I'm in your fucking room right now on television. I'm never going to go away.
There was a little bit of vindication. There was a little bit of vindication. You know, it's funny because, you know,
obviously you're happy and, you know, I am, you and Robert are very close, but it was less about sexual relationships
or, you know, like physical relationships, and more like old friendships and like people from
that didn't believe in you,
that didn't believe in me, or that, you know, like, you know, really made my life hell in school, you know, or or in my personal life in general, you know.
I wondered that.
Yeah, I mean, there's always going to be that moment where, like, you know, I there've been people that I have run into, you know, they're like, "Oh yeah, man, I saw you on the show, great job," you know, whatever, and I'm thinking, "Yeah, you could give a fuck." You know, like, or yeah, I bet you saw me and I bet it burnt you up because, you know, the last time that you saw me, you were like talking trash or whatever.
Right.
And, you know, the cool thing is that for me, that part of that validation of it happening was enough for me. But like when it happens in person or via Facebook or whatever, it's just like,
Yeah, that's good. So after that you were touring or you were playing around with your band Nakia and the Southern Cousins, and
when I got here after the Small Stars
you're doing that for a while. How did you find out about The Voice, and
I had already done Southern Cousins, put that to bed in 2009 right after my dad died. None of those people really wanted to tour, and I was basically, you know, bankrolling that whole thing. They were all hired guns.
Yeah.
You know, so I was trying to take care. I didn't even ask them to rehearse without paying them. I was so committed to that band.
Can I point something out? Sure. Last night I was kind of standing around hovering while you were talking to your dudes, and the way that you handled yourself on that level was really exemplary.
Oh, thanks, man.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Just like the way that you talk, it's all very open. You're very cool and understanding. I know this is a very small thing, and it's probably something that doesn't even faze you, but you have very good manners when it comes to being a band leader.
Oh, on thanks. That level. Well, you know what, man? That is one of those things where, again, it was both that's how you do it, and, oh, that's not how you do it.
Yeah.
You know, like watching and learning.
Yeah.
Because I know how I don't want to be treated, and I definitely know how I do want to be treated.
Yeah.
So I always try to be really polite and respectful of those guys. First of all, they're amazing fucking musicians. They are. They're really good. And so it's really difficult for me to even fathom doing gigs without them. They're so good, you know, and they know what I'm doing. Yeah, and so for me, it's super important to treat them, you know, well. If that means I don't get paid on a gig and they get paid before I do, then absolutely. You know, that's the way I've always been. And I think anybody that I've worked with will tell you that. But so Southern Cousins ended September, I think, of 2009. And then I immediately, like, was going to slip right back into doing the piano solo thing at first. And then Alejandro kind of plucked me up and said, "Hey, man, you want to come sing with some Stone songs with me at the Continental Club, you know?" And I was like, "Sure." And that turned into
pretty amazing feeling.
Yeah, it is, because he's so awesome and just so cool.
He's so awesome.
And, you know, and I was like, "Yes, of course. I'll, you know, just tell me when and where." And I went, and that turned into, you know, me bringing the Fresh Up Girls from the Southern Cousins, Carla and Jesse, with me as well. And then us basically becoming the backing vocal section for Alejandro's band.
Yeah.
We did, you know, all of the residency of that for the record that he was going to do at the time. And around the same time, Jesse got married, so she moved off. So it was me and Carla, and we went and did the record with Al and Tony Visconti and the, you know, Street Songs of Love. And as that relationship between Al and my relationship between Tony Visconti and I, both of them were giving me this advice, like, you really need to focus on being a frontman. You really need to get, you know, like, your solo act together, you know. Tony was very adamant about...
Amazing to have that kind of person giving you that, you know what I mean? So, you know, by the time you went to The Voice, you had already had these experiences with sort of elders and people that had... come before you and walked a little further that that do believe in you and are open enough to give you advice. That's amazing. So sorry, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt
you. It's fine. Tony basically said, you know, you should start out just do like something really, you know, rootsy and almost like a no-brainer. Just do like a blues thing, you know?
Yeah.
And so I called up Matt McNabb and we put together the Blues Grifters.
Right.
And so from the end of South By, because during South By I did Alejandro's thing, but I also did a solo piano Nakia thing. I was about to just go right down that trip, you know. And then the blues thing happened. I was like, oh, this feels so good. And I'm, you know, stretching my legs out here again and just, you know, and I was playing the organ and the piano and really just kind of getting into it. And I guess December the 3rd. After we'd been doing the Blues Grifters, like pretty much almost a whole year, coming up on like 8-9 months maybe or so, and I get this email from somebody at NBC. It was like, you know, we're very interested in Nakia for this, you know, new television show or whatever, and it had an image attached to it that had, you know, like the open call cities and stuff, and we'd like to talk to him about, you know, scheduling an audition. You know, and I was at the Chain Drive with my best friend who was the manager at the time, and we were just, you know, hanging out. I was DJing that night, and
there really is no end to what you do.
Spinning vinyl as Experiment, my DJ alter ego. Yeah, and basically I slid my iPhone over the bar to the guy and said, look at this bullshit, how do I get on so many spam emails? Like, I'm going to click that, and it's going to, like, try to, you know, eat all my files, you know? Yeah. Another, you know, sponsored by the International Songwriters thing or whatever, it's one of those things.
Yeah.
And he goes, girl, you better look at that. And I was like, what? He goes, that shit looks real. And I was like, no. And so I replied back, and I was like, sure, we'd be open to talking about, you know, plus, if you want to talk on the phone, because they wanted to talk on the phone.
Yeah.
And I thought it's going to be a sales pitch or, you know, somebody's going
to
ask
you
for $150
and we'll get you your headshots and then you'll be a professional model. Yeah.
So international mail, here I come. And that basically is the exact opposite of what happened. I picked up the phone when they called and they said, you know, hi, my name is Lacey and I work with the casting, you know, so-and-so and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, we would love to have you audition. And then when I said, wait, but is it normal for people to, like, go out looking for people to come to open call? She was like, absolutely. It's totally, you know, the standard thing for us to scout for people. And she said, we'll do open calls and you'll get a private audition. And I said, well, I'm just not 100% sold. You know, could you tell me more about the show? Well, all we know about the show now is there's going to be 4 coaches. Their chairs are turned. We're hoping that it will be on par with people like Sheryl Crow, Lenny Kravitz, Willie Nelson, and Alicia Keys.
That was their initial sort of dream groupings.
And I was like, okay, I'm interested, you know. And then they were like, the other thing that we want you to know is the producer of the show, Mark Burnett, has already seen your footage of you at the piano performing blues and really would like you to audition. And I was like, wow, okay. So I took that kind of with a grain of salt, too, because, you know, they're L.A. people. They could be telling, you know, whatever they want to tell.
Right.
Well, of course, I went to the audition, and I made it on and all that stuff. When I first met Mark Burnett, one of the very first things that he said to me was, you know that I saw your tape before anyone else. And I was like, wow, you know. And then he went on to tell me that out of the 10 tapes, like the 10 clips they showed to NBC – to say, these are some people that we think will be great for the show. I was the one that they, you know, like, were going to put in or whatever. And I was like, wow. So,
yeah.
And, you know, it's no secret that, you know, like, I have an involvement with Sims, which, you know, in my suicide attempt in, you know, early 2000 or whatever. So they...
I didn't know anything about that.
Yeah, like, there's a Sims, you know, like, PSA... Uh-huh. That I did, you know.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so yes. I did. Sorry about that.
Well, in that, I talk about, you know, let's slice my wrist and stuff like that. So no, it's a big deal. It's a big reality TV no-no for them to have any suicide history at all. And so I actually had to see extra shrinks and then get a final Yes, I Believe in Him. Oh, right,
because God forbid you'd not win, and then...
Yeah. So, you know, it was because of...
That's a horrible sound. Right. Go ahead.
It was because of Mark Burnett that, I mean, he fought to get me on the show. You know, he really believed in me that much. And that, to be honest, that, again, talk about validation. That was like, okay, I know I'm meant to be here. Right. You know, this is exactly what I'm supposed to be doing. Yeah. So, that's how I got there.
Yeah. That's how you got there.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question about the show, because there was a couple of things I did want to ask you about. One of them was, you never actually told me how you felt when you got up there and were playing, and I had my moment of my empathic epiphany,
right,
for Nakia.
When I got up there,
when you got up there in the first song, Forget You, yeah, like what was and obviously when the dude turned around, the actual dude turned around, right. So it was
he was first too.
He was the first
34
guy.
Seconds,
right?
That's how long it took. And I only had 90, by the way.
And
it was
I mean, when you got home that night is basically like what I'm like. How did you assess that? Were you in a hotel room by yourself?
Like, well, that's the one time that they kind of isolate us because they don't want us to tell the other contestants who made it on and who didn't.
Oh.
Because they still have
so people. You were isolated.
We were supposed to be isolated, yeah. So they put, you know, a group of us in this hotel and a group of us in this hotel, you know, that sort of thing. And but I did have to spend the night alone, and I wasn't allowed to tell anybody in the outside world. And the only people who knew were Robert, because Robert was there.
Robert was there, yeah.
So, you know, it was one of those things where, like, I was desperate to try to figure out how to get something out to be like, yeah, you know, yeah, like, yeah, I already had that moment backstage with Robert and with some of the producers and stuff who, you know, and all of that. But it was like, I really needed that kind of, I want to tell the world thing. So
yeah.
What I did, which I don't know how everybody else on the show did it, but I started tweeting and posting things for social, or like basically writing them out and getting my feelings about it then out, because we weren't allowed to post that stuff until it happened.
Right.
So I wrote drafts so that everything would be ready to go.
Right.
Because I wanted it to be real.
Yeah.
So I was like, fuck, I gotta get this out. And I was like, wait, I can just write all this stuff now about how I'm feeling.
And then just tweet it later when it airs.
Yeah, and just get it ready to go. And it saved me so much time because we had to live tweet during the shows.
Right.
So we just pull up my drafts, boom, boom. And it helped me so much. It helped me so much, both in a professional sense of like being able to manage the social media part of it. But more importantly, on an emotional sense, just to get it out.
Yeah.
You know?
Because yeah, I needed to share it. Because you were, you know, here you are sitting alone in your room, and you're really like probably the most electrifying moment of your life at that point.
That was at that point. And as far as I knew, you know, who knew if I'd get another one? You know, like, it just like you don't know.
Were you allowed to have booze or something?
No. No, there were people there that did what they wanted to do, but we weren't supposed to have any kind of booze or drugs or any of that stuff. So. You know,
I bet that Rebecca Lobie was putting away the blow like nobody's business. Just joking.
Bless her heart. She wished she'd tried blow.
Yeah. I think I actually had that conversation with her once in Washington, D.C.
She, by the way, she's my TV wife.
She is.
That's our nickname for each other. I'm her TV husband and she's my TV wife.
What do you watch? Oh, shit. Hang on.
What?
No, keep on. Tell the people what you watch. I'm listening.
Okay. What do we watch? What do you mean? No, I mean, that's what we named each other because we spent so much time together on set.
I thought you guys got together and watched like Top Chef or some shit. I'm sorry.
I'm not very
actually
smart.
She's not very much of the television type. Now me and Robert are totally into TV, but not I don't think she does much TV.
What are your shows?
We personally watch a lot of Castle on ABC. Freaking great show with Nathan Fillion. And then let's see, I'm just gonna go through my Hulu favorites here.
Yeah.
Castle, Modern Family, Grimm, anything that's like Battlestar Galactica kind of, you know, related sci-fi stuff, we're probably going to at least check out once. We loved The River. ABC canceled it. It was great. We were really getting into GCB or GBC, whatever. GCB, Good Christian Bitches, the new teledrama, whatever, from Aaron Starr. It's all on Hulu, but they canceled it after a season. But it's great. It's about, you know, these these, you know, hoity-toity women in Dallas right. are all, you know, it's stabbing backs. It's very designing women, kind of Dallas-y, you know.
It's scary.
Yeah, but, you know, we love that kind of stuff.
Before I get off the voice, I wanted to ask you one more question, because this is one that I thought was pretty weird, and it was something that even again, after I started doing this podcast, I thought of you last year. You know, they solved my mom's murder case and put yes. the guy in prison, whatever. So then I was on 48 Hours, right? And
right.
so on the 48 Hours, they really encourage people to go to this Facebook page and tell people what do you think? Like, who do you think did it?
Right, yeah.
So I go to this thing, and it's like 2,500 comments about, like, it wasn't a majority of them that were against me, but there was some mean shit
oh,
people
yeah.
said. And was there any kind of, like, because you were so confident, and you are, and as you should be, there was no shame in who you are and
right.
your life when you were
sure,
on there.
Yeah.
And you know, there was a moment that you thanked Robert that was really moving.
Yeah.
You know, and you realize, and I would hope that that would educate people that may not, that may see a difference between the same sex couple or opposite sex
yeah.
couple. Like, really, like, you see, it's just the same thing.
Yeah.
You just have this hang up from somebody putting this in your head and freaking you out.
Yeah,
in some
I mean,
way.
They told me very early that, you know, I had very serious questions about that. You know, how are they going to portray me and all of that? And they were, you know, really.
I don't think that they really exploit any bullshit
no, they
on
didn't.
People.
That's
or
just not their style.
Yeah.
And they purposely. I mean, they told me up front. They were like, you know, we both of your what they call reality producers or your story producers, we're both gay.
Right.
And, you know,
so
I
they'll
think
handle
that,
it.
And we think that we'd like to, you know, to really try hard to portray you in a positive light and use this opportunity to show that, you know, gays are normal. We're not going to pay any special attention to the
right.
fact that you're gay.
That's what
it's just normal.
That's what I liked about it.
Yeah.
And I thought, but was there any sort of backlash? Did you get that, you know, moment?
There,
where
you know,
like,
there's
you
always
going
to be people that are going to have, you know, the either they're, you know, whatever, they're extremists on this side, or they're just ignorant, or both, or whatever. So there was a certain amount of, you know, like, oh, well, you know, fat this or faggot
right,
that,
right.
or, you know, I can't understand what he's saying. He's just growling.
It's like they never
you know?
Even got a chance to get around to the fact that you were Mexican.
Right. Exactly. No, and that's weird because we didn't, you know, we didn't, they kind of left out my whole dad had just died of cancer and he was Mexican, all of that stuff. And they focused on that with Vicky. Vicky, my teammate who
right,
went
right,
past
right.
me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Her
yeah.
dad had also just died. So that was her storyline. And they used her last name and everything. Vicky Martinez, 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 Martinez.
Nobody ever
really knows that my last name is Reynoso and then I'm Mexican and then
right, right.
high school my nickname was Wetback. You know, like
right.
So yeah, I mean it was that kind of thing. So I was there was that element that I mean, even last night, here's a perfect example. There's still that element. C3 posted yesterday afternoon, like, catch Nakia from NBC's The Voice tonight at Stubbs, you know? And they posted a link to get tickets or whatever, you know, part of Band of the Year, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then somebody below, the first comment was, no, you know,
yeah,
that
yeah,
kind
yeah.
of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just like,
yeah.
you know, I'm just like, yes, please. And I wanted to write, yes.
Yeah.
or
yeah.
thank you,
yeah.
you know, or something. But I'm just like, that's fine.
Yeah.
But, you know, if that part of it, I mean, there's always going to be a certain amount of it, especially if it's truly filled with hate, that's going to hurt. But there's a song on the record, actually, called Trash Talk, that is all about just that, about getting to a point in your life where, you know what, you realize that
yeah.
that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Because you've got music, and you've got friends and real people.
Right.
And that's what pulls you through.
Yeah.
Not and that only separates us.
Yeah.
You know? And that's why I have this tattooed on my arm.
That's the lyrics from
Quiet Company.
From Quiet Company.
Yeah.
Read it.
We make our lives worth living when we love each other.
Yeah.
You know, because to me, when I heard this, and I'd heard it a bunch of times, but I was on my way home from an exceptionally bad day, had some really, you know, a lot of kind of personal drama going on with, you know, this person or that person, and this person doesn't like me or
yeah, yeah, yeah.
whatever. And that song came out. I was just moved to tears, and I'm driving like this, and I drive like this all the time. I see my arms, you know. I'm like, oh, that was my song. So that was me wrecking, and then I wreck. I'm driving like this, and I look at my arm, and I think, I just want to put it right there so I could see it all the time, you know, just to remind myself that there's never a reason to hate anybody. You know, like there's always going to be something good that I can find. And if not, then we shouldn't be, you know, gelling, you know, whatever.
I love that guy, Taylor.
Oh, man.
He's on the show. He's a great, fantastic conversation.
He's one of my favorite people in the whole world. And, I look up to him so much as a songwriter and just as a person. He does such a great... He's
a good guy.
Somebody who's just a really good guy, and he deserves everything that he gets that's good happening to him, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So since we touched on the social media thing, I reached out on Twitter. I know you saw this.
Yeah.
This is going to be a new thing. I did it on the last episode too, and it works out pretty well. Okay. So I have some questions. I told people, do they have questions for Nakia? And the first one that came back was a celebrity, local celebrity.
Oh, wow.
Beto.
Oh, wow.
Beto from KLBJ says, would you do another reality show not based on singing, i.e. Survivor, Jersey Shore? Use my pen name, Rock Hard Nip. That's what he... Oh, I guess he doesn't want to be known as Beto. He wants to be known as Rock Hard Nip.
So it's bleep from so-and-so. Bleep. Yeah. Well, you know, when you sign up to be on a reality show on any network, one of the clauses is that you basically are agreeing to do other reality shows that they want you to do for like a year. So if Mark Burnett or NBC wanted to throw me in a reality show, they technically could. I think that they may have verbally released me from that part of the contract, but I don't know that they've physically released me from it yet.
You might get a call from like Donald Trump.
Right, yeah.
You're on The Apprentice.
Exactly. And, you know, I mean, geez, I don't think that it's something that I would want to do, but certainly if I'm still contracted, I'm going to have to make the best of it. But, I don't think it would be something that I would really want to do. I mean, I watched some of that Duets show that just came out.
Yeah. I didn't see that.
I have to tell you that if there was a version of that, that like...
was cool.
That was... I think they did a really good job from what I could tell. But I mean, that idea of it, like, I just love singing with people, you know? So like the other day I was in the studio and this guy was like, man, we should just do a record of you and duets.
Yeah, that's...
you sing with all these other people.
Yeah.
And I thought, man, and then my next thought was, that'd be great television. You know, but it's already happening. But I just meant me as the star. But anyway, that kind of thing, if it was music and it was engaged in something that I was already doing, you know, like putting out a record or whatever, then yeah, it would make sense. But not Survivor, not, you know, The Apprentice. Or
not you and Robert on the World's Greatest Race or whatever.
Right, or like A-List Bears or whatever.
A-List Bears. Let me ask you a question. Obviously, bear fits your look and everything.
Sure, yeah.
And that's what it describes. Big dude with a beard, right?
Well,
no,
I think that there's definite like division in the bear community of what bear means.
Okay.
And I'm one of the guys that catch flack for saying, to me it's just a state of mind, you know. It doesn't matter what you look like or whatever. But there's some hardcore people that are like, it doesn't mean big guy, first of all. It can mean, you know, skinny or whatever. But yeah, I mean, basically
sweet,
most people,
like teddy bear,
sure,
kind of.
I think most people's general conception is that it's a big bearded guy or big hairy guy. And I'm totally cool with that.
Big hairy guy.
Right. So
what is there a name for little dudes like me, like squirrel?
Well,
would I be a squirrel?
I think, you know, if I was, I would, you would definitely be either cub or otter.
Cub.
If, you know, with more facial hair,
like
you'd be
otter.
An otter.
Yeah.
You know? But yeah, really, you're
a cub.
You know, you're kind of a twink.
I like that.
You're kind of a twink. So
sad.
Yeah.
Always be the child. Okay. So from Martin Venter, on Twitter, he says he wants to know if Nakia will be coming to South Africa anytime soon.
Sadly, I don't think that I will be going to South Africa anytime soon because I have to really focus on the United States once this record's done. But that being said, I did go to Kenya, East Africa, when I was 18.
Wow.
And built a house over there for a summer. And I would love to go back to Africa and spend any amount of time.
Well, we'll get you back. Andy Van C wants to know, when you were auditioning for The Voice, what was going through your mind when you were saying, oh, you already talked about that.
Yeah, well, I never really said what was going through my mind, though.
Yeah,
you know,
it?
I mean, to be honest, it was kind of a, my thing when I walked out was, how can I get this audience excited?
Right.
And I just was telling somebody from Austin who's about to audition for season 3, and they're in LA right now, the same advice, which is, I went out and I treated the room as if it was just like my favorite Austin venue, you know? And in their case, I said, you know, just pretend it's Momo's, you know, and go out and play it, because those are the people you've got to get on your side immediately. And then treat the cameras, you know. Don't pay attention to them during the blind audition. Pay attention to the people. You know, if you get farther, you can get to work the camera later. And then once you get coaches to turn around, that's when, you know, you got to be able to control it.
Yeah.
You
can't just stop singing.
You can't.
Like, I did it.
Yeah. I'm on. That's it. CeeLo, you're it. I'm stopped. I'm good, right? We're done? Okay. You know, because that's not. So for me, that was what was going through my head was, how can I get this audience excited? That was one of the few things that I actually, you know, took. Picked my battles over.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Was I said to the musical director, please, please let me have the four measures at the beginning of the song that go, dum dum dum, dum dum dum, dum dum dum, dum dum dum. They were just gonna have me, ladies and gentlemen, see you, Jeff. You know, right out.
Yeah.
He goes, oh man, you know, we're already at, you know, 90 seconds. You're already over time. You know, we can't change it. You know, sorry. I said, man, it's just that part of it gets the crowd. That's what's going to tell CeeLo what song I'm singing. You know, yeah. Everybody's going to know what it is.
Before you start singing.
Before I start singing. And it's going to vamp people up.
Yeah.
And he's sorry. And then I hear, no, we've already talked about it back here. He's right. He's got a point. That's good television. Keep it in there. And then,
so people are listening to you.
Yeah, there was people in the back who were listening.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and so then the musical director's like, well, you know, we're already at, we don't care. It's good television. Leave it in. So I got those four measures, and that was huge, because if you watch the way they edited the show, as soon as I started the dum-dum-dum, Adam Levine goes, oh, it's your song.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
like, this is it, you know, and that was perfect for television.
Yeah.
And throughout the whole process, you know, Mark Burnett and all the other producers would constantly say, we need great moments on TV. Great moments, you know. And so that, to me, was a great moment.
You know, what was really cool was that the great moments on that show seemed to have been made more with music than with anything else.
Yeah.
Than having, like, the, you know, the guy that's here from Iraq or whatever. Not that that's bad, but that's always like an American Idol kind of, like, sure, the soldier
guy.
Well,
they did that this season. They did that this season. But you know... it didn't work.
Hey, yeah. Whatever.
Yeah.
So, but the ones that were made on that show were made more musically, which
it was,
which I thought was very cool.
Our cast was, I mean, we were very unique and had a real connection, and that's why the tour did so well. I mean, as far as like the reviews and everything, we worked really well together.
How was that tour?
That was fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, look, it's like, you know, you go from doing the Saxon Pub thing and all of that sort of thing, and then boom, you're playing a Live Nation show, you know, with trucks and buses and, you know, thousands of people, pyrotechnics. I mean, the screens,
all of it.
You know, there's a huge rider. Everybody's got their own hotel room. I mean, it was like being in the Partridge Family, but in the, you know, 2011, basically, you know, because all of us were just this kind of mismatched people together. But yet we worked really well together, and because of our time on the show, we just had this great chemistry, and we did our songs each night, and we did songs together, and we did songs on our own, and it was huge. And the best part about it was, as soon as it was over, I thought, well, I won't get this again for 20 years. You know, like,
maybe you will.
You know, that's a real nice glimpse.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So stale.
Stale bread.
Stale ass. Any chance of a guest appearance with Small Stars?
Oh man, if
they play,
if Miles is going to do something, yeah. I just called Miles to tell him that I'm pitching. My manager also manages David Johansen and the New York Dolls. And,
oh, awesome!
And the rumor is there's going to be a new Buster Poindexter record, and so. Mm. I'm pitching to my manager, and he will then pitch hopefully to Buster Poindexter, that I do a duet with him.
That would be amazing.
Yeah, but it's a Miles song that we did in the Small Stars called The Drinks Are On Me.
Nice.
Yeah, so, and it was one of my favorites to do with him, and so I'm hoping we can pull that off.
That's awesome.
It's perfect for Buster Poindexter.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I was in a band that got compared a lot to the New York Dolls.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And I had an amazing moment with the New York Dolls, two of them. One of them was, I was walking through Hoboken with my friend Joseph on a Sunday, and a street was closed. There was tons of people. I was like, what's going on? He's like, oh, it's a street festival, but we can cut through it. And right when we cut through the middle of this street festival, you hear down at the end, it's like Pecan Street. ladies and gentlemen, the New York Dolls. Swear to God, I was like, are you kidding me? This is amazing. So we went up and we watched them on this little, just like, it was just like Pecan Street Festival, just like some little side street and a fucking little stage, rickety. Right. And
they probably just tore it down.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And then a couple of years ago, I met Sylvain at I'm walking down the street.
Wow.
Yeah, and he said the greatest thing for me, or to me. I said, Syl, and he goes, yeah. And I was like, I thought that was you. And he goes, yeah, it's me. I swear to God, he said just like that. He goes, I go, dude, will you take a picture with me real fast? And he goes, yeah, but hurry up, man. I've got a lot of time. I just love this whole New York trip. That's That'd be awesome. Great, man. Yeah, you and David Johansson. All right, so the last one comes from Christopher Robbins. It says, ask him if he has a favorite movie. If so, what?
Angus.
What is this movie?
Angus came out in the 90s. Patrick Reed Johnson wrote the short story and... Patrick Reed Johnson directed it. The short story was wrote by this guy, Chris Kretcher. Short story was a lot more intense. You know, it's a fat kid, high school jock, you know, or a high school nerd who plays football, gets picked on a lot.
Yeah. Did you play football?
I did. Yeah.
Okay, go ahead,
for a very short period of time. But you know, he has a love interest. He's after, you know, he's lust after this girl and whatever. You know, and of course there's the big, you know, prom scene, all of that stuff. It's all in there. But the short story is based on a short story that's super intense. You know, both of his parents are now divorced and gay and have, you know, he has two mommies and two daddies, and, you know, he gets ragged a lot about, you know, whether or not he's gay at school or he's got AIDS, all this, you know, crazy stuff that they kind of homogenized into this other movie. It did really well. It had, what's the guy's name from Dawson's Creek? James Vanderbeek was in it. It did really well. And I was in Atlanta at the time, and I just really identified with it, and it's just so funny. There's parts of it, Kathy Bates is in it. It's hilarious, and I've seen it a million times. So it's just like one of those, you know, one of those movies that I know I'm always going to love.
Yeah.
You know? I've cried in it. I laugh a lot more than I cry.
That's good. That's good. So, Nakia, man, let's get to where you're at now.
Okay,
let's
great.
Let's talk about Nakia.net/pledge.
Yes. Yes. That is my new album that we are making through the fan-funded, the crowdfunding site Pledge Music. You know, it's very much like Kickstarter, except that it's not. Basically.
Yeah, Robert told me explained it to me last night. But
yeah.
But more than that, like, where are you at with the record? What have you been doing?
Sure.
Like, since The Voice, did you get together with a lot of different songwriters?
Lots of songwriters.
Are you happy with what you've been doing? Are you?
I think the songs that I've written are the best songs that I've ever written. The demos sound really cool. And we've been releasing some of those to the pledgers who've already pledged, and we'll release some more. But, you know, for me, I had very little exposure to songwriting and co-writing with people. Yeah. And so as soon as The Voice was over, that, instead of using, like, my newfound fame to...
Walk around the grocery store and see who knows you?
Right. I basically... started calling up people at BMI, and even though I'm a BMI, I call people at ASCAP and start saying, "Hey, I was on The Voice."
Right? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm going to put out a record. You should totally connect me with some of your best songwriters, and just to see what they would say.
They all pretty much said yes,
and they were all like, "That's a great idea. Here, would you like to speak to you know, like
yeah."
And so it was very gratifying for me, and as soon you know, I've been fortunate enough. I've worked with Mike Daly, Lamont Dozier, the guy that I was telling you about earlier, the Chicago song, his name is Blue McCauley. Mm-hmm. All of these guys have just had huge hits. I mean, Lamont Dozier wrote half
you know,
everything, you know. So it's just like that experience for me was so, has been, and hopefully will continue to be, the biggest part of what I... It's given me so much happiness that I think that is how I'm now starting to, like, look at success, too. Like, well, how have I written any good songs lately?
Yeah.
You know, like, that's, to me, you know, that's a big part of it. And so, but I find I'm not as driven to do it when I'm not doing it with other people. I get so excited by doing it with other people. And so there's a guy in town now that's here for a couple more days. I'm going to try to connect with him, that one of these people from L.A. who saw me on the show basically connecting me with. So that's really cool.
That's awesome.
But so that's what I immediately started doing, was working with songwriters. And then I would take these songs, and, you know, I mean, you've worked out in L.A., and it's very quick. Everything happens fast, and it can kind of get away from you sometimes, or... You know, even, you know, everybody has their own idea of what the song's going to sound like, or maybe while you're in the middle of the song, you're like, we should produce this and pitch it to so-and-so, you know, or whatever.
Right.
So some of these demos were done just like that, and we, you know, would take them somewhere else or do whatever. And then some of them, obviously, it was just not me doing the controlling, and I'm like, oh, it sounds great.
Yeah.
You know, let's see what, I want to take it to my band now,
you know.
And that's what I would do. I would take the songs... Taking them, you know, playing for my manager or whatever, but then I take them to the band and I say, okay, now let's take this and Nikeify it.
Yeah.
You know, let's do what we do. You know?
Yeah.
And it's really worked out well, because most of these songs sound really pop and very top 40 while still having like soul and R&B blues elements in them.
Yeah.
But they're very accessible, is what I call them.
Right.
Because
mostly what you're doing, a style of music that's while it's real and it does work in bars a lot, it's not like a stadium filling style of music unless you're from like the 60s or 70s blues,
right.
Dude. But
it's a
different world. Yeah. But somebody like you that has like this raw, honest talent and this form of expression that I think that's great. I'm glad that you're able to do that.
I would hate to see you
have this kind of great voice and all this stuff, and just because at this moment that is not what's fashionable, you not be able to do it.
Yeah.
So where are you at with you haven't started making the record?
Well, I think that some of the demos that we've done,
some of the demos are good places to start.
No, I mean, like, they, you know, there's a couple of them that I wouldn't even call them demos. I'd call them tracks. Like, they're just ready to be put on a record.
Right.
And then there's some of them that, you know, well, we need some big black girls to sing on this song, or we want to track live drums for this, you know, that sort of thing. And then just, of course, they need to have a common thread, which is we're going to need to figure out, because a lot of them are, you know, two with this guy and three with this guy, or one with this and one with that.
Right.
So there's not an overall kind of executive producer or a mixer or anything that's like kind of giving them that common thread that they need, you know. And it may even be that there's, you know, one instrument that plays on everyone else, you know.
Yeah.
It's something,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But they all do kind of weirdly fit sometimes when you would think that they wouldn't.
Right.
And, you know, because you know how you do that, man. You'll shuffle them around and like, well, let's hear how this one sounds to this one or whatever.
Right, yeah.
Do they stick? And there's some that obviously just, you know, no, that's not going to stick on this.
Yeah, it's not going to work.
Yeah. Or I bring it to the band and this is like, I don't know if we could play this live, you know. Like, we're just not that band, you know. But you know what? Those guys are so good. That's really very rarely been the case.
Yeah.
You know. So that's what we're doing now is we're basically fleshing out the rest of the demos. There's a couple more that I'm waiting on right now, one with Brian West and one with Mike Daly. And then when we've got those done, then we'll kind of vote on which ones are going to go on the record, and hopefully this
and
project will be pledged and fully funded and,
right.
And go and finish the record and then go back to TV with it.
You give incentives on pledge like you do on Kickstarter. So what are the incentives there for
For $10 or more, you get the record. You get to download the record the digital part. And then $20, you get the CD. $25, like I'll follow you on Twitter, you know, that sort of thing, which apparently is...
I owe you $25. Go ahead.
And then, you know, there's like some of the stuff that's already sold out. The shoes, I had some of my actual Converse shoes from the show. Those sold out. And I have a couple more pair I could put up, but I kind of like them. So. Then the stuff that sold the most has been the personalized mix CD where I just like make you a mix of my favorite songs.
Oh, that's awesome.
And send to you. That's $35. And then there's something called Duly Noted. And Duly Noted is where I send a handwritten note to you thanking you and just, you know, I address it, whatever, it's coming from me. And that's $50. And that seems to be popular as well. That and Coach Nakia. But the weird thing is Coach Nakia is 15 minutes of video or telephone time with me that I will give you advice on how to audition for
The Voice
or what, anything.
Yeah.
You know, whatever. You know, maybe it's even a job interview. Whatever. It doesn't matter. But almost with the exception of one person.
Oh, that's a great thing because you've done fucking everything right. at this point.
So anything that I've put up, you know, or whatever. And so and then the people that have chosen that option, it's $100.
Yeah.
Each have then written me after and said, I pledged $100 for Coach Nakia, but I don't really want you to coach me. I was just trying to find a way to give you $100.
Well, that's nice.
And I was like, well, that's sweet, you know, but, you know, you could just, you know, I don't know. Something else, but I think it's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how you got it's, when does it end? Do you know a date of the ending?
July 15th.
Okay. July 15th, yeah, 2012.
And we're at 28% of target. And that, you know, the other difference between Kickstarter and pledge is Kickstarter, you know, you put your number out there and everything's judged by, you know, this number that you're trying to raise, you know, like money wise. You know, we're going to get, $45,000 or else, you
right,
know,
right, right.
or whatever. With pledge, it's just a percentage, and it just shows, you know, how far along you are, and then people get notifications as
right.
it goes along. And it's, you know, Ben Folds has also been doing this on pledge music, and he was just asked about, like, why that mattered or whatever. And he was like, because that part of the burden, like, why they don't, they're just here to support us. You know, it's like, why do they need to know, like, every right. little thing, you know, they just want to know that we're connecting and having fun. It's perfect.
And then you kind of know where you stand with your audience too.
Absolutely.
How many records you'll just sell off the bat.
Sure. And it,
you've sold them.
It's totally geared towards being artist friendly.
You know? That's good. Yeah. So you don't have to go to anyone's house and make them dinner and do something weird.
I could.
You could.
I mean, you know, there's definitely those options, and there's certain things like you could choose to get like 2 VIP tickets to a show. And then after we're done, we can hang out and have dinner at some place, you know, like one of my favorite Greasy Spoons or something. But some of the options we haven't even announced yet.
Okay.
Like, so next week when we're at 3 weeks,
okay,
there'll be new options that, you know, won't be there. Like, for instance, I'll announce today, since this is airing on Friday,
okay,
that on Tuesday,
yeah,
we will be putting up some of my actual Ray-Bans from the show as well.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that particular one's called The Future So Bright. So you'll be able to actually...
Do you write with Pat? You know, he does a lot of co-writing.
Really?
Pat McDonald, yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, you go to Wisconsin, or he's here sometimes too. You can find him on Facebook. He's one of my friends, yeah.
Cool.
He's real cool. Sorry.
No, it's fine. I love that. Oh, man, I love that. And Barbara's still here, right?
Yeah.
Okay. But yeah, so we're gonna add a couple pair of sunglasses from the show. So basically for, I think it's like, I don't know, I want to say it's like $300, $350 or whatever. Because, I mean, they're real Ray-Bans.
Yeah. Yeah, but shit, they're already like $150
right,
anyway.
So they come with a case and, you know, and we'll do a video chat where I, you know, I'm wearing them, take them off, sign the case or the glasses, whichever you want.
Right.
Or both.
Yeah.
And then you'll watch me put them in a box and mail them off to you.
Wow.
Yeah, we're doing our first video of that for the shoes next week. Wow, which amazing. Hopefully we get funded, because if not, then...
You lost those shoes.
No, I'm not going to send them until we're funded. Yeah, okay, they'll be boxed up, ready to go.
Okay, good.
Because I have to have the money to pay for the postage.
Yeah.
I can't... I may not even have the money to pay for the box. Are you kidding? I gotta... It's a hard times these days. You were talking earlier about people saying negative stuff. You know... Lindsay,
people think you're rich, don't they?
Yeah, of course. Lindsay Parker, who is the Reality Rocks correspondent for Yahoo Music, did a roundup of all the different people from The Voice who were doing Kickstarters and Pledge Music and everything. And she, all the comments, with the exception of like two, were like, well, these fucking people don't need any money. You know, they already had record deals or whatever. And you know, they don't have to, why should I be giving them money, you know, whatever. And it blew my mind, because there's this misconception that you're on television.
Yeah.
So you're loaded, you know, or whatever. And it's so not the case. Yes, we got paid to be, while we were on there, union wages, like, you know, standard. That's you can't be on television anywhere. You can't do anything on camera in California. It's the law. They have to pay you.
Yeah.
You know, but trust me, they pay you the smallest amount
that they can get away with.
And do the least amount that they have to. And sure, if you win, you get $100,000 and a record deal and whatever. But
and you play gigs, you've got a band to pay, you've got managers now, you got booking people, you got a lot going on. Yeah, you gotta carry the weight. So
yeah, it's not what people think it is.
So they can find that. Get out there. I mean, get out there and get involved, you know.
Yeah.
Get involved
and don't just pledge for my project. That's the thing, is the site is set up. You know, like Ben Folds is doing it on there, and What's his face? Toots and the Males are doing a new documentary that they're funding on Pledge Music. All of these artists that you probably are very familiar with, and a bunch of people from Austin are all doing it.
And like people also that you probably like, you know, you might have like Toots and the Males. You're like, I want to. Where are they? You know, they're one of my favorite. I lost track. Where are they?
Yeah,
you know,
find remember some Luscious Jackson?
Yeah, they're doing
they just,
it.
They did it and
they did it.
Pledged and funded. Yeah, their thing's over. And they, I think it was like 200-something%. Grantley Buffalo, like,
did it?
Yeah. Grantley Phillips.
Yeah,
he did it. You know, I mean, it's really hard. Gives me access to you, but it also gives you way more access to me.
Right.
You know, all of the behind the scenes stuff that we're putting up.
Right.
The Pledge Music people even wrote us this week and said, your content is more engaging than any other content that we've had yet.
Right, you know, like, because you're putting up songs, you've got videos of you writing
of
songs,
yeah.
You've got
I record everything.
Yeah.
I have, in this phone,
everything.
I have every songwriting session saved. So not just, I don't just have the stuff like the finished demos.
Yeah,
I've got like the, fuck that, no, that
that's
sucks.
A terrible idea.
No, that's a terrible idea. That stuff is all on my phone.
Awesome.
Yeah, so, and you get to be a part of that.
Yeah. So Nakia.net/pledge.
Or just go to Nakia.net. It's on the front page. Either one.
Right. It's right there. And you've got shows coming up.
This airs Friday. We'll be in Dallas on Friday night.
Oh, are you playing on Friday?
All good. Okay. Yeah. I'm sure you played there before. The Domain on Saturday.
Oh, here in Austin.
Here in Austin. We're back in Austin on Saturday. We play 2:30 for Taste North Austin.
Oh, nice.
Little wine food festival.
Some people can come out early.
And bring the kids early because Biscuit Brothers go on first at 12.
Are they
the kids group, the guys from PBS that do the Biscuit Brothers.
I like how you're looking at me like I'm missing out on
this. You are. They're amazing. It's like Captain Kangaroo, but musical and like cool.
That sounds badass.
Yeah. So it's recorded at KLRU. The guys are great. They're going on at 12, then Paula Nelson, and then us. It's all ages, family-friendly during the day. You'll be at the Domain anyway. You'll be at the Apple Store anyway.
Yeah.
You know, stopping at CPK.
Yeah. What are we missing? Let me say, you have any big shows coming up this summer? Like anything, any significant?
Well, we've got Blues on the Green with Marsha Ball.
Oh, that's fantastic. What date is that?
That's July 25th.
Okay.
And then we'll do one of those Shady Grove, Unplugged at the Groves in August.
So
a couple of KGSR things, yeah.
Yeah, listen to KGSR.
They've always been so supportive.
Yeah.
So.
Is there anything I'm missing? I'm really glad that you came and did this.
Man, I'm glad that we finally did it.
Yeah.
We've been trying to happen forever.
After last night, I was like, I hope that we can be friends.
Oh,
is this weird that I'm doing this on air?
No. When I walked in, I was like, oh, he has a piano and not like an old organ thing. Like,
yeah, you can come over.
I just want to come over and jam with you, you know?
Just fucking hang out, we'll drink beer, jam out.
Yeah, I'll never forget, and I hope you don't mind me saying this on there, but like, I'll never forget the first time that I heard you really sing was at one of those Raji World Plus One things at the big
Big Red Sun.
And it's All Out of Love, maybe? Yeah. Air Supply?
Awesome.
Yeah?
Yeah?
It's you, right? You did that
That's
in the band,
me,
right? Yeah. I'm all out of love. Anyway, and I remember looking at Raji and going, God damn, he can sing.
Thank you, man. So can
and,
you, man.
Yeah, and I was just like, wow. You know, and that band especially, like, there's never been a time where I saw you guys and I was just like, damn, those guys are awesome. Talk about a bunch of really good musicians.
Thank you.
That's the real deal. But, yeah, man, I've always kind of, I hear more about you from people like Todd Wolfson.
Right.
I do from you. Like, I don't know anything really about, but like, if I spend like 10 minutes with Todd Wolfson, he's going to bring up your name somehow or another. You know Johnny Gotti, right? Listen, me and Johnny, we were doing the same. And I was like, what? So it's like, you know, I've known plenty about you just from Todd.
Right.
But yeah, man, I've always wanted to kind of get to know you better. And then
this has happened.
And I really wanted, I thought Kathy was going to be here with a kiddie swimming pool.
She was, but that was a couple weeks ago. She's in Europe.
Oh, what?
But she's, you know, one day, you know, she gets concerned. She wants you to do well. She really does.
Yeah.
She really does. Like, one day we had lunch and just talked for a long time about, like,
because so
I told
real.
Her about seeing you on that, what was going to happen afterwards. And she was like, I've told him he needs to get in there, write some songs, man. Yeah. Don't let anyone take advantage of you. She's so she's a great like big sister figure for
all
of us.
She's one of the people that I immediately went to and said, hey, I can't tell anybody else this, but I'm doing the show. What do you think about it?
Good.
And then as soon as I was home, I was like, you know, here's some songs that, you know, whatever. What do you think about this? And then when I ended up hiring my manager, I was like, what do you know about Ron Stone? And she's like, well, you know, I know him because he used to manage Belinda and blah, blah, blah. You know, so right. It was, all of this stuff was great for me right. Because she knew and she was like, he's great.
Knows everyone,
and,
yeah.
And you're right. She was very like, this is what you don't do.
Yeah.
Don't you sign away this.
Yeah.
You know, all of that. And it was really nice.
Yeah. I like that she's a bigger player in the big world of music, but really looks out for us and cares about our well-being and
yeah, she does. And like you know that. What else too, man? She she's so cool that like she'll show up at 8 a.m. to one of our little taco tweet ups that we
oh,
do.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it's like me, her, Andy Langer, Nanette.
Yeah.
And
invite me to one of those.
Oh yeah,
go.
No, you gotta come. And and the last one we took Leslie Nichols from ACL. You know, she's the other Leslie on Twitter.
Right.
And I may have missed the last one, but you know, like Andy Langer sitting around with him is like in the morning, he's always funny anyway. And then you get Kathy up that early and you know, well, I think she's up anyway because of the kid, but you know, like,
it's fun. When did I move into Hyde Park? This is no exaggeration. Almost every single morning that I was in town from 1997 till about 2004, having coffee with Langer.
Are you serious? Oh, and you're there not like and you're not cynical
like,
about it?
It was like, oh, it was so cynical. And it was also like when I got a deal and all this stuff was
oh,
going
really?
On for me. And so there was always like this.
You were on Elektra, right?
Yeah, the Lars Ulrich subsidiary.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is a story into itself. But anyway, so yeah, I would love that. I would love to.
You got to come to
like,
the taco.
I love how I invited myself, and then all of a sudden I'm like, thank you for letting me invite myself. I would love to do that. Thank you, Nikia.
You're always welcome at the taco tweet up. And when we're done with this, we shall schedule one.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I wish you all the luck in the world, and I'll be seeing you around.
Man.
And I'm an otter, right?
We can go with that.
Okay.
You're definitely more of an otter than a cub, I think.
Okay. Yeah. All right. All right, everyone. Thank you so much. Be sure you go out and pledge for Nakia's record. Nakia.net/pledge.
Yes.
Give some cashish to this man.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone. Woo! All right. Nakia. That was fantastic. That's the first conversation I intended to have when I started this podcast. So I'm glad that we got to have it finally, and I'm glad that we got such a great conversation. It was fantastic talking to Nakia, and I have a new friend. I even have his number. I'm going to start texting him. Like, hey, what's up, dude? Just in the van. That's what I'm going to text him that song constantly. Doon, 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 doon. I want to thank you guys for listening. I want to thank Nakia for taking the time to come by. I want to thank Robert for setting it up, and thank you for listening. And don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes. We have so many episodes. You can go on the Podbean website, howdidigethere.podbean.com, and go back and listen to tons of different episodes. See all the people that were on here, and you can like us on Facebook, and you can follow me on Twitter @JohnnyGowdy. Following me on Twitter. There you go. All right, people. The last song we have is a new song by Nakia. And it's a demo that I think you get for free when you give $10 to Pledge Music. So go pledge this music. Go pledge for Nakia's album, man. Help him make it. It's going to be a good album. He's writing a lot of great songs. And here's a song from it. I hope you enjoy it. Bye-bye.
Have the things I never did. Dream big. jobs, barely had time to sleep. No, you can't get started if you can't even make ends meet. But when I close my eyes, all I could do is sing. Don't dream it.